fleeting glimpses of things seen through a veil, darkly. Do we understand the meaning of these visions of life? Why we are here and how little of our existence we truly understand? Tonight we will talk of these things on The Other Side. Welcome to The Other Side. I am Jim Harold, and so glad to be with you once again. And something that I find, you might not look at it as mystical at first, but genealogy and looking back in the history of your family, and then it almost has a mystical quality. And in the sense of our guest today, her story does have a mystical quality because things that happened generations ago in her family continue to impact her and her family years later. And if that's not kind of metaphysical, I don't know what is. Our guest today is Natalie Zett. She is the author of the very recent book, Flower in the River, A Family Tale Finally Told. And Natalie has a very interesting background, really a Renaissance woman. She's been a writer and is a writer. She's been an actor, photographer, and musician. And actually, she grew up in the same area that I did in Cleveland, which is kind of one of those cool synchronicities. And we're so glad to have her on the show. She majored in business administration, but then she graduated from Luther Seminary in Minnesota, where she received an MA in systematic theology. Or did I get that right? Is it systematic?
You got it right. Okay, all right. Don't ask me what it is, though, Jim.
Well, that's like I have a master's in applied communication theory and methodology, whatever that means.
We don't know what it means.
kind of mine's truly a useless degree. If I were going on to get a PhD, it would have been great, but I didn't do that. But anyway, so glad to have you on the show and talk about this. Now, I know, obviously, you've been a listener to the shows for years. You're a member of the Plus Club. Thank you for that. But what made you decide to get into the history of your family? What made you say, Natalie, this is a story that needs to be told, and I'm the one that needs to tell it?
It was one of those strange things, Jim, where I was somewhat estranged from my family, and I relocated, and I thought it was really smart to come up to Minnesota because I thought, I don't have any family here within a 100-mile radius or 200-mile radius, or so I thought. And I am probably could be voted the least likely to be a family historian. But things happened. And I was up here for about 10-12 years. I got my master's degree from Luther Seminary in systematic theology. And I was working as an IT person because that's what you do with a theology degree. And I did other creative things. And I was grooving along. And then my dad died in 1996. And all of a sudden, every decision I had made and everything that I had done to that point came to a grinding halt, and I had a lot of self-recrimination. I thought, oh God, should I have done it differently? What did I do? And I was in grief, but also just re-examining my whole life. And I think that's appropriate sometimes at junctures like that.
Sure.
And my heart was completely splayed open. I was just, and then maybe a few months later, my mother's sister, who I thought was dead, living in Chicago, she was in her 80s, and a retired reporter. She'd been out of the industry for probably 50, 60 years, who knows how long. But she knew I was a published writer and had a very successful writing career up until that point. And she sent me this 38-page family history. And she said, you're the only one who could do something with this. So besides the fact I thought she was dead, I was reading through this. And my mother's mother, this is about my mother's mother's side of the family, died when my mom was 3. They were living in Johnstown, and the rest of her family immigrated to Chicago, and they stayed there. They lost all contact. So my mother was raised by her father in Johnstown, lost most contact with her relatives in Chicago, and therefore we knew nothing about this side of the family. And I thought, even though I was a curious little kid, I thought there's nothing to learn here. So I started flipping through this document, and because my Aunt Pearl was a reporter and she was so thorough, everything was organized in these little columns and she did everything by typewriter. And I thought, how'd she do that? And I was reading through these names and I thought, these are my family. And so I saw my grandmother's name, Anna Pfeiffer, all these siblings. And then I was flipping through the pages and I saw something that said my grandmother Anna's sister, Martha Pfeiffer, was killed at age 19. In a ferry boat accident. I thought, a ferry boat accident in Chicago. I thought, what? And then I was reading further where there were 800 some people killed in downtown Chicago in 1915. And I thought, no way. Mm-hmm. I would have heard of that. I was always drawn to Chicago, even as a child. And I'd been to Chicago a few times on the way from Ohio to Minnesota. You stop through Chicago. Mm-hmm. I always felt a connection with Chicago. So that's where it started. I thought, how could we not have this? And by then, I had this information. And by then, I was writing regularly for one of the local papers. And I thought, I'm going to write about this thing, whatever this thing is. And I couldn't find any information. Again, this is in the 90s, and the internet was not quite what it became.
Right. It's in its nascent early days.
Nascent early days is a beautiful way to describe that. And went to the library, and I thought, what is wrong with this? And I thought, why have I not heard of this woman? Why have I not heard of this disaster? So that's how it started. And I don't want to just keep rambling on if there's one you want to direct this, but that's how it all began. With me as a reporter is how it began.
And again, you have such a great varied background, writer, reporter, also now you're an IT specialist. Now, let me ask you this. Do you feel that, you know, we certainly get our health characteristics, our appearance and so forth through the lineage and so forth. We inherit different physical traits. Do you also think we inherit different spiritual traits and perhaps worries and sadnesses of past generations somehow?
I think you're right. It's a difficult thing to prove, Jim, but in terms of my life, one of my cousins said, after like 500 coincidences, Natalie, maybe it's not a coincidence anymore. There are just so many things happening that were. And for me, I want to backtrack a little bit to when I was in Cleveland. My family was ethnic. All four of my grandparents were from the old country, Eastern Europe. We don't know what countries they were from, but they were from there. And my mother insisted we were German and we were going to be raised Lutheran, forgetting that my dad had a whole other lineage, but that didn't count. And so one day we were in Shaker Square. I know you know what that looks like. Yeah. And I was maybe 4 or 5 years old. And there was a book, a Hebrew book, and it was out on the display. And I was looking at it and I said, well, I know what that is. And my mother said, you do not know what that is. And I said, well, what is it? I've seen this before. And she said, you have not seen this before. She said, this is Jewish writing. I said, I've seen this before, and I think we're Jewish. And she said, oh. My grandfather was a member of the German-American Bund. That was her father, the pro-Nazi group in the 1930s.
Oh, my.
So, yeah, I know. So she tried to silence that. But in fact, years later, after the DNA test, yes, you're Jewish on my father's side, at least partially. So it was one of those things where I absolutely, for whatever reason, even though I was the outlier, the black sheep of the family, whatever, I was able to resonate with certain things. And that happened all the way through. Even my move up to Minnesota, back to when I was digging around that little genealogy or family history that my aunt had written, I saw something else besides the Eastland, besides my Aunt Martha. I saw that my great-great-grandmother and her children had immigrated to Western Wisconsin, which is about an hour and a half from where I was living.
Now, and go ahead. Go ahead.
Yes. No, you go ahead, Jim. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you about this Eastland disaster because Cleveland has a lot of old history, like with the Torso Killer and those. So these local cases I'm fascinated by. And as I understand it, the Eastland was an excursion boat and it was known as the Speed Queen of the Great Lakes, right?
You did your homework. Absolutely.
I do my best. I do my best.
You did your homework.
Thank you, Google. Beautiful. Thank you, Google.
Yes, thank you, Google.
But my point being, tell us a little bit about that and your family's role in that, because I got to tell you, that's very powerful when something like that happens.
Right. So the Eastland was one of, I think, several ships that were chartered for Western Electric's annual picnic, the Western Electric, Cicero, the Hawthorne plant. I'm sure that a lot of people have heard of that, with the Hawthorne Works studies and things like that about efficiency studies. That was all around that. But my grandmother's sister, Martha, who was killed, was not an employee of Western Electric. My grandmother was, but she was pregnant. So she gave Martha what I call the one-way ticket. And Martha was 19, and I think she was kind of a badass, truth be told. Some of the photos that I have of her, I thought, what were you into? But she was a character. And so she and her girlfriend were lined up. The first ship was the Eastland, and the thing was already was noted for its listing problems and already had unsteadiness. So what they did is they loaded the bottom with, I guess, with concrete, and then they put a bunch of lifeboats on top, and it's just like,
that does not sound very safe.
Well, there was one woman who I met at one of the Eastland events many years later, and she was a little girl when it happened, and she ended up in the water, and she said her memory was that it was like an egg that just kind of flipped over in the water. It was so quick. And so thousands of people, I think there were 2,500 at least on the ship, on top and below, in the water. And then again, it was just a matter of, this is 1915. It's a hot day in Chicago. People are gathered around. And it's like, I mean, there was a photographer on the scene, I think, just to photograph it for the maybe one of the papers. And it's just like, there you are. All of a sudden, everything changed. So they're drilling holes in this thing, trying to pull people out. I've gotten a lot of footage that I found that was lost for over 100 years that I'm going to post on my website that will show some of the what actually happened. But it was horrible. And they didn't have room for people. So they were taking, you know, horses and whatever types of transportation they had down to the 2nd Regiment Armory, which eventually became Oprah Winfrey Studios, laying them out there. And it was just chaos. So I cannot imagine what that day was like. And then my family, in the meantime, was sitting back home wondering, you know, she couldn't possibly have been gone. Her father was had just died the year before. The family had so much tragedy. They were living in Southwest Chicago, and they were all living near each other. These people who worked for Western Electric, there was not a single, I think all of Chicago was hit by this thing. My great aunt was buried in Bethania Cemetery, which is next to Resurrection Cemetery. And I'm sure people have heard of Resurrection Mary, right next to Resurrection Mary. There she is. And then, but also the Bohemian National Cemetery in Chicago, I think, had the most victims of the Eastland. So this was just chaos. And how, again, Jim, how something like that could get lost in history telling, I don't know.
And the thing is that these old cities, and again, I mean, you have to, you kind of have, when you look back, I think we tend to, and I do this too, look back judgmentally, but really it is true that safety was not at the top of the mind. It was not like they'll be okay. Everything will be fine. You know, if a few people die, hey, we made some money. I mean, I'm not saying that's the case in every like old American disaster, but I think it is the case in many American old American historic disasters.
Mm-hmm.
Just the kind of disregard for safety. It's kind of like, what were these people thinking? I know there's a story in Cleveland, and I don't know if it's apocryphal or if it really happened. I think it may have happened, the Collinwood school fire. And if I remember correctly, I remember even hearing this when I was a little kid in the 70s in elementary school. The reason the doors now go out is because there were kids found burned to death because the doors did not swing out. They pulled in, and kids were trying to get out of this school fire, and they were burned to death because they were, you know, it's just your kind of instinct to push out, to get out. And they couldn't get out because they were panicking and pushing instead of pulling.
Yeah, that is a true event, and somebody actually did a recreation of it. I just see it a few years. I'll try to dig up the link for you if it still exists.
So
it's powerful.
Now, how do you think that this tragedy for your family resonated through the years, through the decades?
Sure. Well, one of the things, again, we were talking about judgmentalism, and I think, you know, my sister and I were going back and forth about this too. And I said, we cannot understand the mindset of people from that era. That's because right. There was no psychological help. There was no social welfare programs other than a few things that the Red Cross or Western Electric might have given these families. So when they had tragedies, they sucked it up, but they didn't always suck it up really well. And so what happened was my grandmother, my mother's mother, went to the morgue to identify her sister. And again, what did that do to my grandmother? And then her first marriage was falling apart. There was a lot of violence, I think, with the first husband. And she eventually divorced him. And then eventually she had two children, one of whom was my Aunt Pearl. The other one was a boy. She left them to go back to Johnstown to marry my grandfather. So she left the kids in Chicago with their grandmother. And my sister was saying, why did she do that? I said, I don't think she could take being in Chicago. When I was working on the book, I thought, Grandma, why did she do such a thing? But I think her heart couldn't take it. Literally, her heart couldn't take it. And then she had my mother in her second marriage. And when my mother was three, my grandmother's heart exploded. And she died.
Oh, my.
On the floor in their home. So the story was lost. So when I tell the story in the book, it's like that the story should have been lost. My mother didn't grow up with the story. And her older siblings were far, far away, and they certainly didn't talk about the trauma.
Yeah, that was the thing. I mean, you know, today it's like, okay, let's take whatever trauma happened and let's talk about it and talk through it. Mm-hmm. And it was diametrically opposed back then. It's like, okay, let's not talk about this. This happened, but for example, in my dad's family, and this is only in the 50s, they had a significantly younger brother. My dad had a significantly younger brother who was probably, I don't know, he was about 13 years younger than my dad was. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he died of cancer. And very tragic. I think he was about 6 years old, 5-6 years old when he died. Mm-hmm. And you could just tell when you talk to my dad and his siblings, they would occasionally talk about, but they weren't comfortable with it. They didn't want to talk about it. It's kind of like, well, it happened. Let's not talk about it. It's an awful thing. And I think that, you know, up until relatively recently, that's been the coping mechanism, and obviously not a very good one, is that, okay, let's not talk about that. That's unpleasant. Let's try to put that back deep in our minds.
Correct.
So how, you know, how do you feel the echoes of your predecessors?
Well, as I moved my way to get away from Cleveland, I mean, I loved Cleveland, but it was never home to me. That's the weird thing. I thought, I don't belong here. And it was almost like as if another, I'm very much, I should say, qualify this by saying, I am, even though I grew up with my very magical family on my dad's side, they're Eastern European. We had the Roma thing going. They were also a Carpathian Rusyn. They were always casting spells, talking to the dead, doing all these things. And as I was growing up, Jim, I thought, why can't my family be like the Leave It to Beaver? Why are they like the Addams Family? I wanted normal, so I did. They're the Munsters, you know. And I thought,
For the record, the Addams Family and the Munsters were much cooler than Beaver Cleaver's family.
I know, but I wanted to be normal. But, you know, that ship sailed a long time ago. Excuse the shit metaphor. But you know, kids are, I think we rebelled because we tried to find balance. I think we just kind of go against the grain. And my mother was a little bit more on the logical side. So my dad's side was a zany musicians and doing all these things. But I wanted something normal. So I think I kept going west. And I thought, this is where I'll find something. But the first time I went to Chicago, I felt like that city was watching me. And I felt as if I never had a city affect me like that. And I thought, I want to be here, but I got to get out of here. And then the further I moved westward to, you know, Wisconsin, because you have to go through Wisconsin to get to Minnesota, Everything seemed familiar to me. And I thought, this was years ago. This was before my father died and everything else. But there was something familiar about this place. Even though I seemed to not have any family and I seemed to be very original in what I was doing and I was very self-congratulatory, I thought, boy, you are really smart. And I said, Queen Cities is a great place. It's progressive. It's artistic. It's everything, you know, that I am. And it wasn't until circling back to when my father died and my aunt sent that genealogy that I realized, since my ancestors were buried just across the border here, I thought, Lord God, I returned to the mothership. And so there was the effect of researching this and realizing that, like my Aunt Martha, who died, I almost paralleled her steps.
Hmm.
Those are facts that I can verify in terms of my moves or whatever. But then, Jim, as I was getting close to writing an article about this Eastland, scraping every place I could to try to get information and about my aunt, it was as if I was no longer alone in this quest. And I was living at that point, I was single, living, you know, by myself in an apartment. And I was starting to feel I was not by myself in this apartment. I thought, am I cracking up because of dad's death and what's going on? But I said, no, I think I feel something here. And then when the time came to write the article, it really wasn't very good. And I thought, oh Lord, I need to go to the cemetery to see her grave. I just have to see some of this to drive down to Chicago, which is about an 8-hour drive from the Twin Cities. because I drive slow. And the first thing that happened is when I went to the cemetery, it's monstrous, and I didn't know where they were. I thought, what did you do now? And when I was in the cemetery, I was running around trying to find this thing. Nobody could help me. And somehow I didn't realize it, I think because I was so crazy from lack of sleep, that I had parked right in front of where their graves were. When I walked back to my car, I saw it. I thought, oh, Lord. So finding the graves was one of the first things that happened, besides that feeling of whatever. And I thought, oh, my. And then when I knelt down by the graves, I thought, I didn't even know you people were here. I got very emotional. And there was a sense of just kind of being out of the body and back in it again. And I thought, what is going on here? And when I drove back to Chicago the next day to finish my article, to get it to my editor, there were things in my apartment that started happening. Things were flying off the shelves in the other room. It wasn't a very big apartment, but stuff on top of my refrigerator kept falling off. And I thought, now what is this? And I kept putting things back. And then it happened about three times. And I thought, okay, what do you want? I thought, who am I talking to? And it was one of those feelings of, you've got to be kidding. I had seen things like this growing up, but I had forgotten about them. Some of the seances and stuff that my dad's people would do. I thought, I know this is possible, but I put it way, way to the back of my mind. Because right. I'm a rational, sophisticated artiste, don't you know? And I thought, oh, the Addams Family has come back. So I think that, I'm not about explanations. I'm always about asking better questions. So it's like, is this possible? And I think it is, that not just I inherited the DNA from that family, but I think I also inherited memory. And I think the whole thing of le door by door from generation to generation, it's a two-way street. I'll say that again. And I think as I paid attention to my Aunt Martha, she was returning the favor. And I remember being so scared that I called my mother. My mother just died a month ago too, which is really interesting to me that as the book started, my dad had died, and now as the book is out in the world, my mother dies, they bookended it. I called Mommy and I said, Mommy, I think I brought something back from Chicago that I didn't intend. And she said, what are you talking about? I said, I think Aunt Martha's here. And my mother, who's a skeptic, a lifelong skeptic and unbeliever, though she kind of hoped for something maybe was possible, she said, you know what? She said, if that's the case, she's not going to hurt you. She said, just talk to her and pay attention. I said, okay. So that's how that all began. But the continuation of the contact with her, my aunt, there was tactile things that were happening. I could feel like somebody was touching me. I could feel like somebody was kind of, I don't want to use the word guide because I really hate to talk in cliches, but as I was stuck on writing this article that eventually grew and became a book, it was as if I was led to certain people, certain places, whatever, that were giving me the information I needed to fill this thing out so it wouldn't be just this boring. And then she died, you know, all the in-between things. I thought, what happened to you in between that dash of life to death? And I felt I started to know what she was like.
And that's really, and that was that's really interesting because, I mean, not to that extent, but it's almost like you have a genealogical soulmate, like somebody in your family that you really relate to. I'll give you something that happened to me. when I was a little kid, I think it was 1978, my uncle, my great uncle Ernest, who I think maybe I met once, when I was too young to realize who I was meeting or anything, or I only have a very vague memory of maybe going to his house. And he died in 1978. And I went to his funeral. It was the first funeral I ever went to. I think I was 7 years old when that happened. 7 or 8. And, well, no, I would have been 8. So anyway, next time we went back to visit my aunt got, you know, a lot of his effects because she had been the one who had been his caregiver. And he got a ton of books. He had a ton of books because he was a school teacher. And he was considered the smart one in the family because everybody else was pretty much, you know, definitely blue collar, definitely, you know, I come from a family of coal miners on my dad's side. And the thing is, but Ernest was the one, he taught school, he went to university, he even, I think, did some teaching at a university. So, and he had a ton of books, and among those books were some metaphysical books. And they gave me a bunch of metaphysical books. I was 8 years old. I probably shouldn't have been reading these you know, I was kind of young for that.
Cool.
But
so cool.
I mean, you know, and all these kind of, it's almost like a lot of kind of, it's almost the secret before the secret. And people like, I think one of the guy's name was Norvell. And there were, other people. Yeah. Yeah.
Neville, I think, right? Yeah. That guy.
Yeah, there were a lot of different things. And, anyway, it was just really interesting to me. I always kind of felt like he was my intellectual soulmate because, you know, as a kid, I was pretty bright and, you know, went to university and so forth. And it was very unlike the rest of my family. And I felt like this weird genealogical tie to him, although I knew very little about him and never really met him as someone who could have an intelligent conversation with him. But when they would say different things, like he had gadgets and things, and I'm a big gadget guy, a lot of weird parallels that you would think would have nothing to do. Maybe it's just coincidence, but maybe there is something passed along in the genes, as it were, that's not just about whether you have blonde hair or brown hair or blue eyes or brown eyes or, you know, whatever the trait may be. Maybe there's more to it.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. And when saying that, my dad always would throw around, I kind of ignored it when I was, you know, kid, it's in the blood. And he would say that we could do certain things. Like, my dad was a virtuoso musician. He had his own radio show in Johnstown and WGAR in Cleveland.
Oh, yeah, I worked for WGAR for a while. way later.
We were way later, but he was, you know, in the 50s. And but he would, how do we know how to do certain things? I don't know. How can we, without training, do things? How, for example, for myself, I'm a polyglot. I can look at any language and pretty much read it. And I don't know how I know that. But then as I went deeper into genealogy, and this is like a parallel track that I was doing with researching my Aunt Martha, I became a forensic genealogist. I still do a lot of forensic types of work, meaning that I'll look up birth parents for people and occasionally deal with some of the more unsavory things that have happened with people. But part of it is using the science, but also part of it, Jim, is I use a lot of my intuition, even though I will never say that. Part of it is I can feel where I'm supposed to go. I can feel that this person who's departed wants this to be found, and I can find it, and I'll give it to a client or a friend or whatever. How did you know that? Found it in the newspaper. I'm never one to come straight up and say it was magic, but in some ways, the blood is the magic. Some ways the blood is that river that travels through us. And I think that as the only difference about what happened to me, Jim, is that I paid attention and I thought, why not? Let's have an adventure. And let's just say I am going crazy. Oh, well, it'll be fun. But I think that I got led into, you know, my second half of life here, my life's purpose, for connecting people with their long lost families, for connecting myself to my long lost families, for making sense out of the craziness, that is my family, and looking at the darker things of my mother's father's past, for example. What was he doing with those groups of marching in Madison Square Garden with all the rest of those neo-Nazis in 1939? What can I do to educate people to say, this is not a good idea, folks, you know, and you can make choices. So it's also about which dog or whatever do you listen to on your shoulder? You know, what do you follow? Yeah. And we're born with all sorts of wonderful and horrifying things. And both my parents had severe trauma, too, in both of their lives. So, again, then they parent to us two kids. And also they made choices, too, to try to be better people. And I think that's what sustains me. So, I would say, too, Jim, that one of the biggest gifts that I gave to my mother before her departure from this earth is her history. And my Aunt Martha was actually the bridge to restoring the relationship with my mother, because she couldn't believe I'd found all this stuff out about her family, and she knew nothing. And she said, "You mean we're all this?" And I said, "Yeah."
Yeah.
And I think it was a healing thing for her.
Yeah. And my dad, you know, it's like when my dad and my mom passed in 2013, but my dad's still with us. But when I used to say, well, what are we? What's our background? Well, I'm American, I guess. And then they would tell me some gibberish about some stuff that was 90% inaccurate. And then with the DNA testing, and I did some genealogy, I was basically able to trace it back, mostly British or Scottish, but which makes sense that they settled in West Virginia. So that kind of makes sense. That maps. They came to work in the coal mines and so forth. Actually, my mom's side is way back in the 1700s. They were very early. My dad's family was the mid 1800s, so a little bit later. But regardless, being able to tell an elder that information, that's very rewarding to say we did come from somewhere and we are Americans, but we're not just Americans. And, you know, that's really a good thing. And yes, in the course of doing that, you might uncover some unpleasant truths. But I think that the only thing that we can do as people who maybe find something that's dark in our family history is try to be better people and try to counteract that badness in maybe somebody who was in our family, because we had nothing to do with it. But we can try to be better people and carry the light forward.
I agree with you 1,000%. And I think, too, it's a choice. When you know your history, you're less likely to repeat it. And you're less likely to be blindsided by some weird thing that you want to do. And there's a more conscious way of living even when you connect to the ancestors. And I think that that's what's made a big difference for me. And it's made me more confident as I go out into the world and talk to other people who have been even more traumatized than my family.
Sure.
And can give them something of hope and also have a good time with it. You know, I do think they want to be found, and they will be found if you pay attention to them.
Very good. Well, we've been talking about Flower in the River, A Family Tale Finally Told by Natalie Zett. Natalie, where can people find the book? And I also know you have a website. So tell us where we can find both. Oh, too. Okay.
Well, the book is available on all the usual suspect lists. It's on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And I published wide. I've created a publishing company to do this because no agent would talk to me because it wasn't categorizable. But Amazon has me as a very highly rated genealogical book, as well as occult fiction, which I didn't intend, but there you go. And then I also have a website that has a long name, but it's the same title as the book. So it's www.flowerintheriver.com. But if you type my name, you can easily find it, Natalie Zett. And well, thank you, Jim.
Well, thank you, Natalie. Thank you for your support of the shows over the years, and congratulations on this book and continued success with it.
Well, thank you, Jim. I so appreciate it.
And thank you for tuning in to The Other Side. We certainly appreciate it, and we hope that you enjoyed the show as much as we did. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you next time. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye. Thank you, Natalie. That was great.